Hello and welcome to another episode of Laps Gamer Radio. I'm your host, Stuart Neil, and joining me tonight is a special guest from Threefold Games, is Shella Ramanan. Hello, Shella.
Hi, nice to be on here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on and speaking to us. We'll get straight into it then, and we'll start with sort of how did Threefold Games come to be?
Yeah, so I signed up for a game jam in Bristol, the XX Plus game jam, which was for trans, non-binary and women who wanted to make games. So I went along to that and was introduced to Claire and Sharon, and we were kind of sort of thrown together as a team, as you are at game jams. Mm-hmm. The theme was borders. So we threw around some ideas, and I'd had this kind of idea in my head, and so I sort of suggested it to them about a woman with dementia sort of walking around a house interacting with objects, and we thought it kind of fitted with the theme of borders, you know, in terms of sort of the sort of mental borders and, you know, borders in terms of memory and reality, things like that. So so we did the jam, you know, sort of stress and and stuff that is a game jam, and then we presented it at the end the next day, and it won the Audience Choice Award. So it was the game that people most wanted to see finished, which really spurred us on. And so we formed our team, Threefold Games, and have been making the game ever since. So that was 2016.
What was the, was there a little bit more sort of to do with the inspiration, what have you, behind Before I Forget Them?
Yeah, so I write fiction in my spare time, and I'm kind of preoccupied with memory and memory loss and things like that. And so I had this idea for a woman who with dementia, and yeah, what happens when these people who suffer with dementia and the loved ones who are kind of left behind, and they're seeing the person they know kind of slip away from them, but there's still a person there, it's just not the one they've known. That was just an idea I'd had kind of sort of kicking about in the back of my mind, but it never sort of wrote itself as a story. Sometimes that's the way it goes. You have to find the right form for the story. I've had that before with a story idea I've had, and it came out as a radio play, and I'd had it for years as an idea, but it never worked as prose. And this was the same idea. Once I was writing this as a game script, it just really worked. So that was pretty much the inspiration.
How much has Before I Forget changed since, or even evolved since, the game jam?
So the old overall story arc hasn't changed that much at all, really. The visual style, it has evolved. We've kind of, it's sort of like a sculpture where you start with this rough outline, and then you kind of hone and refine it. So it's been refined. I think straight after the game jam, we had a conversation about the kind of look we were going for, and we wanted to use pastel colours and a light, airy feel, which kind of differentiated it from the games that it's going to be naturally compared to. So like Gone Home, you know, What Remains of Edith Finch, which all have quite moody lighting, particularly Gone Home. Well, it's a thunderstorm outside that house, so it's quite dark and gloomy and kind of gives you this spooky feel. And we didn't want it to have that feel. We didn't want that feel to come from the atmosphere, from the house, from the lighting. We wanted, you know, the sort of unsettling feel to come from other places, like the audio and just the sort of tricks we play with the expectations and things. So the look was set down really early, and so was the story arc, but we've just kind of embellished things, and there were problems we had to solve with things I'd written into the script, and then Claire the programmer was like, how the hell are we going to do that? The layout of the house is probably the thing that's changed the most, which is it's really hard to design a house that works in in gameplay terms, in terms of the player's path through the house working, but also feels like a house. So we watched, you know, lots of videos and kind of talks. We watched a talk with the Gone Home team and how, because obviously that's like a really great blueprint for a house that works and feels like a house. But then actually when you see the map of their house, like the real life map of their that house does not work in a physical space like a house. It's very much a house designed for a game. So we didn't go the same. They have a sort of hub layout for their house, and we tried that and it didn't work. So yeah, we've gone for a more sort of natural feeling house.
What about the audio aspect of the game?
Yeah, so the audio, I suppose the one thing that's changed the most is probably the music. So we had, we've gone through different, kind of trying to get that feel that we wanted, because the music's really key, because it's kind of the, almost, it's the only thing we really hear that's, it's the thing that represents Dylan most, and Dylan is the person that Rashmi, our protagonist, is looking for. And so the first, you know, instance of her coming upon Dylan is hearing the music, because he's a pianist, he's a composer. So that's a really integral part of him as a character. So that was something we needed to get right, and we didn't have it right at first, and then we got a contributor, someone I knew, who wrote some music for the radio play I mentioned earlier, actually, and he wrote this beautiful piece of music, and I was like, can we like just use that music? And he's like, oh, I'll do you a new piece, and he did this piece and it was just perfect. And when people hear it, they're just like, oh god, the music, and it kind of brings tears to your eyes. It's all very emotional. So that was a key thing that we needed to get right. And the music isn't a soundtrack as such, so it's triggered in certain places because it makes sense for the narrative. So when you first start playing the game, it's very quiet. So I suppose the audio is quite minimalist. It is as if you're standing in a really quiet house where not much is happening. So and it's about sort of getting the personality of the house, I suppose. So we're slowly layering in things that we're thinking of, you know, whether it's the sort of pipes creaking or and floorboards and, you know, different sounds on the doors and things like that.
Before Three Fold Games, then, what experience does the team bring?
Okay, so if we start with Sharon Taylor, she's the audio designer. She's currently doing a master's in audio design for games. I think it's audio and music for games. And prior to that, she was quite a successful dance DJ. I think you can find her on some of the Ministry of Sound CD compilation things and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that's her background. And Claire Morley is, she's, doesn't work in the games industry. She did a degree in paleontology and geology, and taught herself to code. She now has a job, something to do with databases, something technical. So that's a more technical role for her now. Yeah, she does something computery. So she's the programmer, and she also did the art. She's quite big in the Bitsy community. So she wrote, if anyone sort of Googles Bitsy tutorial, they'll find Claire's tutorial. So she's one of the key figures in the Bitsy community, which is a small sort of game making tool which is becoming quite popular now. So there's myself. So I'm a video games journalist of around 18 years. So I've been writing about games for a really long time. I've sort of do all sorts of things in the industry. I'm sort of diversity advocate on the board of Women in Games, vice chair on BAME in Games, podcast host. So just like writing, talking about games, diversity, the industry and stuff. And a fiction writer in my spare time, so unpublished fiction writer. So this is my first game that I've written.
Very impressive list of skills and things that you've all brought to the team then.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it's a good team.
Back in April, you were at EGX Raised with Before I Forget. Mm-hmm. Whenever you're showing at events like Raised, it can obviously be an expensive proposition with the renting of the space and what have you. What are the benefits of doing something like a games convention, and are there any drawbacks?
Yeah, I mean, the benefits are just getting your game in front of people and sort of getting some reactions and feedback, because otherwise you're just creating in a bubble and, you know, maybe sharing it with other developer friends. But obviously they're coming from a different perspective, sort of a knowing perspective. And it's not the same as seeing someone just who doesn't know you from Adam walk yeah. up and play your thing and, you know, can just go walk away without, you know, because they don't feel it, they don't owe you anything. They yeah. don't owe you good feedback. So you get this really honest feedback, which is invaluable. And, you know, we take notes, and it's also a really great place to bug test. We were really lucky at Left Field. There were no bugs, and Claire was so happy. She's like, oh, I can feel like I can walk away because there are no bugs. So yeah, it's invaluable in that sense. But it is hard financially to make it to these things. And, mm-hmm. you know, people tend to want like postcards or badges and things to take away, sort of marketing things. And yeah. when you're a team of three doing it as a sort of passion side project, you kind of don't have the funds to put into that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so only two. Well, we had the two of us, me and Claire, and two of our collaborators managed to come along to Left Field. But, you know, Sharon is, you know, trying to finish her master's, so there's the time aspect and the travel and yeah the expense of accommodation, all those things. But it is a really great experience getting it in front of people, so it kind of has to be done. And it is fun, and it's the rewarding side of making a game. I mean, you make a game yeah. for people to play it.
Was there anything that came out of the feedback on the game that has influenced any of the changes that have been made?
Not at Left Field so much, but we were at Adventure X in November. So the first thing we ever did was a really local Comic-Con, which was actually happening at the top of my road, and they were giving us a free table because we weren't selling the game, we were just showing it. So we were like, well, it'd be rude not to. So we were just like, this isn't going to be our crowd, because it's going to be like 12-year-old kids, and, you know, it's like, here's some reading, kids, about a woman with dementia whilst there's like, you know, like stormtroopers walking around. So we were like, this is not going to be our crowd, but it's a good test space. So we went, and actually we were really surprised by the sort of, because it was a younger crowd, so 12, 13, 14 year old boys and girls, and, you know, all sorts of people, and they were really positive about it. But we discovered that one of our sequences wasn't working, and just things that people got confused by, not being able to find objects right at the beginning. So right at the beginning it's blurry until you pick up her glasses, and then you put them on, and then the world comes into focus. So there was a thing where it was just too hard for some people to find the glasses when it was blurry. The other thing was there were no sound effects at the beginning, so people thought that the sound wasn't actually working. So we put in sound of traffic going past the house and things like that. So yeah, there's really loads of little details that you can just see, the places that people are getting stuck, places where the dialogue isn't working or misleading them. Yeah, there was just like some really crucial challenges that it helped us solve.
Mm-hmm. You'd mentioned there sort of the age range of the Comic-Con not necessarily being the demographic that you'll be aiming the game at. Mm-hmm. What sort of target demographic are you sort of aiming for?
I suppose it's going to be older teens upwards, I would say, just because of the subject matter. But I mean, that's an assumption we make. But then when we did take it to the Comic-Con, you know, people are, because it's about dementia and it is when you watch people play the game or the feedback we get afterwards, because quite often people are quite moved by it when they play it because they've had personal experience. And even though you think, oh, well, dementia, for a start, Rashmi isn't old. It's early onset dementia. So it's not like an old lady. You know, there'd be nothing wrong with that. But why can't we have older people as protagonists in our games? But so the assumption is that young people won't be able to relate to that. But young people have grandparents, so who may have been touched by dementia. So it touches all sorts of people. So I think our demographic is basically people who are interested in story-led games, and also people who maybe don't play these kinds of games but might relate to this subject matter because it's touched them in some way.
What about looking sort of forward and to the future? What sort of release date are you looking for?
We're looking at maybe February next year, so 2019.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What about any conventions then in between now and then?
Yeah, it depends where we get into. So I guess we'll apply for Adventure X again because that's just a really lovely space and it's dedicated to narrative games. So that's an obvious one for us. I don't know what else is on the horizon. We're just like, when opportunities come up to submit, we do. There's been news of a narrative game festival in Boston next year. I'm not sure what the date is looking like for that, but that would be obviously like a really nice fit for us. And if we manage to get some funding, then we'd be able to go and do that. So it just depends what comes up, basically.
What about showing it at EGX?
Yeah, I mean, that would be, it depends on funding, basically. Yeah. That's a real hurdle for that one. So, yeah, it's something we've got to discuss as a team, what things that we want to pay for. We'll have to see. Watch this space on that one.
What are your feelings about the indie developer scene at the minute?
Well, I think that the community, I mean, as far as, you know, that my experience of the community, being a developer in the indie dev scene, like everyone's really warm and supportive and really ready to give us advice and share kind of links to funding leads and things like that. So we're really lucky because we're based in Bristol. Well, I actually live in Somerset. I live in Taunton in Somerset, but you know, Bristol is the home of Claire and Sharon, and the Bristol Games Hub is just a really supportive space and does really great events, sort of press events and pitching events and all sorts of workshops and things. And then we've got the Girl Gamers, run by Constance Flurio, which is, you know, a space for female game devs, so we can meet up there, and there are all sorts of workshops going on there. So in terms of that, it's really great. I don't know if you mean the sort of marketplace, the indie game marketplace, which is like a bit of a scary prospect. Yeah,
it's a very scary prospect at the minute. I've seen an awful lot of people sort of mentioning in tweets and things just about how their games are doing and sort of selling, and the numbers aren't necessarily what they would have hoped or even potentially expected. That kind of actually leads me into asking what sort of the plans are for promotion of Before I Forget.
I mean, it's really hard because it is, we're in this precarious place, or this place, well, not precarious, but we're looking for funding, so whatever comes up we're applying for, and then sort of pitching to publishers and investors. So the level of promotion and marketing is going to depend on which one of those things you know, we go for, or like who goes for us equally. So if it's just us alone and we're we're self-publishing, then it depends how much funding we've got. Mm-hmm. But recent feedback we've had is that, you know, people really like the concept and think it has a really clear hook, which makes it easy to sell into the media. Mm-hmm. Not easy, but easier, because it's got a very clear kind of news hook to it as well. So I guess it's just getting it in front of as many people as possible and, you know, making sure we're at as many shows and things and, you know, mm-hmm. doing all the sort of marketing things like, you know, having a mailing list and all those sorts of things. And which is hard when, you know, you're working a full-time job and doing this in, you know, the hours and days you have spare, and you want to work on the game, but then you've got to try and maintain a kind of community and buzz behind the game as well. So yeah, it's tough. It's so you definitely don't do it for fame and fortune.
No. What I've seen is indie games seem to struggle to get outside of the just sort of the general games bubble. Mm-hmm. In sort of their sort of the knowledge of the games themselves. Mm-hmm. There's been very, very few, even some of the really big names, like things like Thomas Was Alone or Fez, mm-hmm. Seem to struggle even just to get outside that, although a lot of the traditional media these days is helping, mm-hmm. with a lot more articles and reviews and things appearing in, you know, papers like The Guardian, mm-hmm. The Telegraph, Independent, etc., and things like that. But it's still, I think it's, from what I've seen, it feels like it's very much of getting somebody within the media who is wanting to sort of champion your game to really help to get the name out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there is still, I think within the games industry, we think that we're mainstream sometimes, yeah. when actually we're really not still. You know, people know Grand Theft Auto and Lara Croft, mm-hmm. but they're still, you know, lots of people don't recognize all the games that are telling really interesting stories and, you know, don't have guns and warfare as their mm-hmm. sort of central premise. You know, still when you speak to people, you know, I'll do, you know, sort of interviews on, you know, BBC regional radio or something, and people don't realize the breadth of games that are out there, which is a real shame. And I think things like, you know, sort of like getting into exhibition spaces and galleries, which is happening now. There's things I've been part of as part of the Ensemble kind of thing, which was part of London Games Festival and mm-hmm. London Games Week, which is another thing that's quite, you know, that is good at like putting games on a sort of like on the cultural map as just part of the lifeblood of our capital city. Mm-hmm. You know, things like that do help, but it's a slow process. So you have to find someone who's empathetic to games or maybe the subject matter of your game, which I suppose is maybe why the publishers who advised us that, you know, they think it could be a good hook for media to latch onto because mm-hmm. it's such a universal topic.
Yeah. It does seem that these days, unless you're on the side of a bus or your children are talking about it, it very rarely gets heard about by anybody.
Yeah, unless it's like Minecraft or Fortnite.
Yes.
You're not going to make it onto Channel 4 News.
No. Is there anything that you've seen that platform owners, such as Valve owning Steam and itch.io and Humble, etc., could maybe do to help? Or is it just the nature of there are so many games coming out these days that it's very hard to find what people are looking for, even for people within the games industry?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what they could do other than sort of, I don't know, curate things, but then you've got, that's another form of gatekeeping, isn't it? You know, because then they become a sort of pseudo publisher then.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is just the absolute like glut of content we have coming out, which is both positive and difficult. to navigate, mm-hmm. both for as a consumer and a creator.
Mm. You'd mentioned earlier just about trying to build up a little community as such of mm-hmm. people who are interested in the games. What way are you going about that?
Well, I think we had a little sort of guest book thing at our table when we go to shows. So we ask people to write comments like you would, like if you went to a hotel. So we get little feedback comments and people put their email down. Quite a lot of people are finding us, which is quite nice. Yeah, just trying to, I guess, just get out to events, do Twitter, you know, just all the regular things. We haven't got any magic formula.
Yeah, I'm not sure there is one, to be honest.
I know, right. So yeah, just doing the usual things, just trying to be seen. And that's the really hard side, is trying to keep up with, you know, updating mailing lists and, you know, doing blog posts. And yeah, the people that do all those things, I just don't know how they do it all, get all the time. So yeah. It's such a small team as well that's tough. But
yeah, you just don't have a social media manager or anybody who is prepared to do
sort
a lot of
dedicated.
The work on things like Discord and what have you.
Yeah, exactly. So it's hard, but we do as much as we can, and hopefully people who do you want updates, kind of bear with us. I know I have with games that I've waited for years. They're still on my radar, like Gorogoa. I mean, gosh, that was one person doing that beautiful game, and I was waiting for it for years, and I didn't mind because, you know, I knew I was going to love it, and I did. So that's the nature of being an indie fan, isn't it, I suppose?
It is, yes, definitely. Well, even some of the big companies and what have you are taking a long time to finally get games and things out.
That's true, yeah, it's true.
You know, it's so very often that games are being delayed until, you know, a year later than they were actually due to be coming out and things.
Yeah, it is becoming more that way, yeah. Which is better than rushing it out and everybody just tearing it to shreds on the internet, I suppose.
Within the industry, how important is diversity within the industry to provide a range of stories to be told?
Yeah, it's incredibly important that people who play games see themselves represented, because that's a sign that you're welcome in this community. You know, and it is a big community because there's lots of crossover between, you know, the consumer and the creator. You know, we're kind of one and the same in a lot of ways. You know, consumers become creators and, you know, become journalists and whatever. But if you don't see yourself represented in the stories or even in the people working within the industry, you know, there's not spotlights on sort of trans, disabled, LGBTQ, people of color, you know, if they're not being interviewed or they're not even at the table, then, you know, storytellers are going to make kind of insensitive mistakes when they do represent people, you know, and it's just going to become sort of hurtful and a bit sort of demoralizing and, you know, this sort of sense of that this space isn't for you. So yeah, diversity is really important because, you know, this is the modern storytelling medium, and we know that stories build empathy. So, you know, we're trying to create this sort of loving, nurturing world where, you know, we're kind of sort of building bridges working against this world that seems to be intent on isolationist kind of sort of approach to the world. And storytelling is a really good way of, you know, building those bridges and sort of creating empathy. And, you know, interactive storytelling is an even better way of doing that. So if we're telling diverse stories, if our creators are diverse, well, I mean, the bottom line is they'll be more successful projects and they'll make more money. I mean, so if money talks, then...
Yeah. Would a more visible diversity in the industry help to expand the potential audience for the games?
I suppose it would in some ways. I suppose it depends which aspect of diversity you're talking about, because we know already that, you know, it's about 50% of players are women, even though they're not represented in the industry, you know, very largely. And we know that in America, sort of Black and Hispanic gamers actually buy more games and play games more than their white counterparts. Yet in the UK industry, is only 4% representation. So I don't think there's a problem with the players. I think there's a problem on the other side of the table. You know, we're not kind of representing our players, basically, in the sort of the products we're feeding them in, you know, the things we're creating. So we just have to be more mindful about the stories and experiences we're creating. And also, you know, about thinking about the pipeline in terms of who we're hiring, instead of hiring the same people, you know, look at a broader base of talent, because it's out there. There are fans there. They're playing our games right now and probably want to do these jobs that we do. So let's like help them in.
Is there I hesitate to say easy solution, because no solution should be easy, but is there a better way of trying to make the diversity a lot more visible?
The diversity that we already have?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I suppose there are simple things, like when, you know, a journalist says, can we have a spokesperson to talk about, you know, blah blah game that you've just released. You don't just go for the same white guy who's always talked about your games forever and a day. So it's about sort of just spotting the talent you do have within your team and, you know, giving them a chance to shine. So yeah, there's that, but it doesn't go very far when, you know, there isn't that much diversity in the first place. I mean, if you're talking about 4% BAME representation, and we don't even have the data on what roles that 4% sit in. So they could be in the accounts department, in which case they're not going to be, you know, on Kotaku talking about the game. I think we need to look at hiring practices, like where we're advertising our jobs, you know, that the sort of expectation, you know, that you're not going to just the sort of Russell Group universities, which are overwhelmingly white and middle class, you know, that you're doing sort of more outreach and just more thoughtful recruitment.
Is it a good thing that a lot of white male developers are turning down the opportunity to sit on panels to help sort of increase the amount of diversity on those panels?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, because, you know, sort of, you know, white straight men are pretty much the gatekeepers of the industry. And if, you know, they're not kind of being aware of their privilege, their place of privilege, then, you know, they're just, it's just becomes that kind of boys club, and they kind of ask each other to be on panels and be in interviews and whatnot. So yeah, you absolutely have to, which is why sort of Women in Games and BAME in Games are sort of inclusive diversity organizations, because, you know, we can't do it alone. It's like the BAME 4% cannot change the face of the industry. We can only do it with the rest of the industry on board, and it's the same with Women in Games, you know. Sort of everybody has a responsibility to help the industry become more diverse, but especially the people in positions of power and privilege, which, you know, is white men.
With the variety of things and the sort of the toxic environment that is created by some groups of players, it does make the situation very difficult to sort of push through any changes and things. It's just one of those things that the industry itself has to work on, and hopefully changing a culture within the industry will then sort of influence the players as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's this very vocal minority, which, yeah, just seems to have been empowered by various things happening around the world and in politics and so on and so forth. But equally, you know, the sort of social media gives a sort of amplifies the voices of what I'd call reason and sort of, you know, can means that sort of more liberal communities can find a voice and solidarity as well. But yeah, I think the industry is becoming better at not caving in to those, you know, sort of really angry white internet boys.
That's probably a very good description of them.
So I think they are getting better at just being, you know, we're diverse, you know, making statements about being diverse organizations and, you know, all that sort of thing. So, I think you just have to move on and drag them kicking and screaming, basically, or just leave them for dust.
Hopefully it will change.
Yeah, I think it will change. Yeah. It is changing. Mm-hmm. It's slow. It could definitely be quicker, but it is changing.
Okay, thank you very much, Shella, for coming on and doing the interview with us. At this stage in the show, I always throw it over to the guests to give sort of shout-outs and contact details of where we can get in contact with you. Obviously including your own project of things that you want to promote, but also anybody else's that you believe needs a little bit of promotion as well. So take it away.
Okay, so I'm on Twitter, at Shella Ramanan. Threefold Games is at Threefold Games, so that's all very easy. And through that, you can find all our website and things like that. Things that, I mean, yeah, if you're interested in diversity in games, then, you know, Women in Games and Bame in Games both have Twitter accounts. And Bame in Games has monthly meetups in London, which are sort of social events. So anyone can come. You don't have to be brown to be, come along to Bame in Games. And in terms of games, I suppose I give a shout out to my left field crew. So that'd be Small Island Games. They're doing a really cool game called Haiku Adventure. And then there's the Over the Alps team that are doing a really beautiful game. Oh, I've forgotten all the lovely games that were there. I've forgotten. You've put me on the spot now. But yeah, those are the two really beautiful kind of narrative-based game. Haiku Adventure is doing really interesting thing with gameplay mechanics and using the Japanese poetry form of haiku, and it looks absolutely stunning. In fact, Over the Alps looks absolutely stunning as well. Two to look out for, I'd say.
Excellent. Thank you very much. It has been absolutely lovely to chat to you, so has Shella.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for asking me on. It's been really good fun.
It's always nice just to hear different people from within the industry and their sort of thoughts and feelings about it, and more importantly hearing what they're working on, particularly whenever it is interesting little games that wouldn't necessarily be given the promotion or coverage that an awful lot of bigger games do yet.
Thank you for giving us this platform for doing that. Yeah, it's really important because it's hard for us little people.
Okay, that's all for this show. Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Goodbye.